how I got there was sort of this. Cost feels like the biggest problem. Tuition's going up, student debt is going up, real wages are flat. The cost of higher education is a problem. The only chance that organizations have of operating successfully in this environment is to fight fire with fire. Technology now scales faster than humans can learn. The only chance we have is empowering individuals to learn in a personalized way enabled by technology. Now we've got to say, where exactly are you in the world? Where exactly are you trying to go? And how do we get you there?
Dare to Learn es un podcast para los apasionados del aprendizaje. Cada semana platico con expertos y líderes de estas áreas para conocer sus estrategias, pero sobre todo sus tácticas para hacer frente a los retos del presente y para desarrollar a las organizaciones del futuro. Mi compromiso es compartirte estas tácticas y darte tips sobre cómo ponerlas en práctica mañana mismo y evitar así que seas desplazado por el futuro y las nuevas tendencias. Quiero que puedas hacerle frente y prepararte de la mejor manera para ese posible futuro que ya es presente. Esto es Dare to Learn. Hola, ¿qué tal amigos y colegas de Dare to Learn? Bienvenidos a un episodio más de este su podcast. En esta ocasión me tocó entrevistar a David Blake. Fue una gran conversación. David es co-founder y executive chairman de Degreed, que para quienes vienen siguiendo el podcast desde hace ya los 3 años que tenemos, es el tercer invitado de Degreed, que es esta empresa donde justamente ayudan a través de su plataforma a que las organizaciones desarrollen habilidades y midan esas habilidades. Y eso es parte de lo que David ha dedicado su vida como emprendedor de educación. Pero también David es el coautor de un libro que debería ser de cabecera para todos los expertos o todos los profesionales de Learning and Development, que se llama The Expertise Economy, How the Smartest Companies Use Learning to Engage, Compete and Succeed. Y es en coautoría con Kelly Palmer, que es justamente una de las invitadas del podcast de la primera temporada, que si no han escuchado esa conversación, los invito a que vayan. Todo lo que hablamos siempre con la gente de Degreed es buenísimo, porque siempre hablamos de la diferencia entre aprendizaje y educación, la credencialización del aprendizaje, hacia dónde vamos, y un tema súper relevante hoy, el tema de la curación de contenido, que es una de las cosas que utiliza, que hace Degreed y que es parte de su primicia fundamental para las organizaciones. Y está muy conectado con Dare to Learn, porque justamente, además de todo el tema del aprendizaje, últimamente nos hemos enfocado en los últimos años en el tema de curar contenido. Este podcast es una muestra de eso. Tratamos de siempre estar encontrando las pepitas de oro del tema del aprendizaje o para nuestras audiencias. Y justamente hace menos de 6 meses que estrenamos curso de curación. Ya lo teníamos en el tintero desde hace mucho con algunas conferencias por aquí y por allá. Pero el tema de curación que le hemos llamado hackeando la información y que desarrollamos nuestra propia metodología y que hemos tenido la fortuna de dar, de llevarlo a varias empresas, la más recientemente PepsiCo Latinoamérica, donde justamente porque están empezando a utilizar Degreed, necesitaban un grupo de curadores para darle batería a esta plataforma. Entonces a un grupo de más de 40 personas tuvimos la oportunidad de hacerlos verdaderos curadores de contenido que compartan con impacto y que le sacaran todo el provecho a esta plataforma de Degreed. Todo esto se los platico porque, bueno, yo conocí Degreed hace muchos años gracias a seguir a David, seguir a Kelly, seguir a Lori, que es la otra entrevistada del podcast, y les recomiendo esta porque, bueno, esta es con el mero, mero CEO y tenemos mucho, mucho que aprender y que sacar de esta conversación. Los dejo con el episodio. Muchas gracias, como siempre, por estar aquí. Nos vemos del otro lado del aprendizaje. Dare to Learn.
So, thank you, David. Thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
As I told you before, you are our third guest from the Degreed family. I think it's never seen before. but I'm very glad that you have the time to do this. I hope we have a great conversation around learning.
Yeah, excited.
So my first question that I like to do all my guests is, what is something about learning that you believe it's very clear to you and not so clear for other people?
I think the one of the big epiphanies I had along the way that made a big difference in my journey was realizing that learning is really quite different from an education. And, you know, I really came to realize that I had managed to become an excellent student, but failed to become a good learner. And I think that, you know, begins to draw out the distinction between learning and education. Education is the system through which we progress, and you can succeed inside that system, you know, with a lot of different skills, primarily in America, being good at test taking is the one that'll serve you best. But that isn't really true learning. Being good at taking tests is not the same thing as really being a great learner. And so I think, you know, when we talk about learning and education, people tend to think of them as one and the same. But I really like to draw out the distinctions.
Yeah, love it. I don't know if you have seen that. Do you know Heather McGowan? Have you heard of her?
Mm-hmm.
She has a graph, a very interesting graph, where she actually mapped out like the education, then you work, then you retire. That used to be the paradigm. Now you have, I love how she switched the words. Now it's not education, it's learning, and it's throughout the whole life of the journey. So it's interesting. I think it's on the point with what you're saying. I heard a couple of interviews where you actually explained your epiphany during the SATs, right? That's cool.
That's when it happened. When I sat for my entrance exams and realized that, like, you know, this is crazy. What is this thing and why do we do it?
Cool. And I think I want to touch on the myths around learning later on. So I think that's one of those. And well, can you tell us a little bit more about you, your story, how it connects with what you do today? I like to think that we all have key milestones in our lives and that we can all relate those to a kind of learning. Can you tell us briefly on that?
Yeah, I mean, that really, the SAT was a really big early fork in the road. So, I mean, that's kind of where I trace it back to, which growing up as a student, I was very studious. I excelled in the classroom and, you know, would go on to graduate near the top of my class in high school. And it really was when I sat for the ACT, in my case, that, you know, I'd studied for it. I ended up scoring very well. I knew full well its importance. But it was like the actual act of taking the test. I just looked around and was like, you know, hold on, like, you know, this doesn't make any sense. These tests, they aren't what we learn in the classroom. They aren't what we're going to learn in university. You know, it just felt sort of unjust or unfair. Like, I was able to take test prep, but I know a lot of my peers hadn't. And this is sort of half of the equation for what university we'd get into. And that's sort of half of the equation for what jobs we were going to get. And just looked around and thought, you know, we're 17. Like, this is crazy. This sorting mechanism we have, why do we do this? And so I started asking. I asked my teachers, I asked, you know, counselors, like, and everyone knows the importance of the test, but no one knew the history of the test. You know, when did it, was it developed? Why was it developed? You know, sort of in reaction to what was it developed? No one really knew. And this was before the days of Google. So, you know, my answer is I went to the local library and really, you know, didn't find a lot on high stakes testing. But began to find other books around learning and mindset and the history of our education system and, you know, some of the innovations that were happening at the time. The charter movement was really sort of catching on. So read a lot about the charter movement. You know, and it began to snowball. And, you know, and that set my life off on this course where I had that epiphany. I'd become a great student, but those books that I had gone and checked out and read, I realized was the first thing I'd actually really studied that a teacher hadn't assigned to me. And that was this epiphany of, you know, oh my gosh, what is this feeling? Oh, that's curiosity. Oh, I've never felt that before. You know, I don't remember this feeling, and realized that I had managed to get all the way through, my schooling, you know, at the top of my class and had failed, you know, to become a good learner. And so I committed, I wanted to be a great learner. I mean, even if it came at the expense of being a great student, resolved to do that and just continued. All that energy went back into learning more about the systems of education. And so the books that I continued to get were all about education, and sort of this curiosity turned into a passion, turned into an obsession. And I have now spent the entirety of my life sort of obsessing over, you know, the future of our education systems and the future of lifelong learning.
Great. That's great. And You mentioned the charter history. What is that?
Yeah, so charter schools. So in the States, we have a long history of private schools and of course, a history of our public education system. But charter schools are sit in the middle of those. So they are independent. They're independent schools that admit students and use taxpayer money to fund it. But it's sort of this sort of in the middle. They can they have more leeway in terms of how they structure things and curriculum and how they format things. So and it was just really big. You know, right when I sort of fell into all of this, there wasn't actually a lot of innovation happening in education. You know, the again in the States, the for-profit universities were also really sort of in their heyday right in that moment. And you know, and there were some arguably innovations to that movement. They were sort of the leaders in moving online. But also our for-profit universities, you know, collectively have been an enormous part of the problem in student debt and graduation rates and poor placement rates, things like that. So it wasn't a really fruitful time in education. You know, for the most part, when I fell into all of this, it was a time when still everyone believed the system was sacred, that, you know, college was the de facto universal way to, you know, succeed. It was the only pathway. We had sort of, you know, as peak this narrative that college is the only successful pathway forward out of high school in America. You know, it's got a long sort of 50-year history, but, you know, probably was right at the peak when I started really thinking about all of this.
Wow. Well, yeah, you it was good timing then for you to find out.
For the rest of us. Being early is the same thing as being wrong. And I've probably been, felt the pain of being a little early in this journey at every step. Wow.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, I have never heard that about being early, it's kind of being wrong, but I'm glad you were early and that now you are seeing the things that you're doing. And I think that gives me a bridge to ask you about the grid. I mean, when after this journey, when you became a passionate about this, you founded the grid. And for the folks that haven't heard about the grid, can you explain a little bit what is the grid?
Yeah, and I'll give you just very quickly my sort of just my resume, because I actually think it speaks to the journey and some of these themes, which was I wanted to become a great lifelong learner, but I didn't exactly know what that meant. And our system of education very much is this kind of conveyor belt that once you're on it, you know, it just is designed to take you places. So I went from high school into university without really thinking about it, you know, and I don't regret it. I had a great experience, but just because that conveyor belt, that's where it takes you. So I went into university, and in university, I would study economics. And that conveyor belt just sort of takes you to one of, you know, a few places. And I became a management consultant because that's one of the places the conveyor belt takes you. And even as I was passionate about education, I was finding it a struggle to how do I sort of engineer my career to be able to work on these problems. And I also wasn't very entrepreneurial, to be quite honest. You know, being a good student is almost the antithesis of being a great entrepreneur. And I was a great student. I was, you know, and so almost by default, I was a crappy, you know, entrepreneur. So management consultant, which again is this very, you know, it's where the conveyor belt takes you. It's a very prestigious sort of a job to get as an undergraduate out of school. There's a lot of validation that comes from it. It's very, you know, high achieving and rewarding and a lot of external validation. And I think that matters a lot because our system of education, both that sort of momentum and the validation that it gives people, you know, where I think learning is more
self-validated.
Yeah, it is. You really have to, it comes from intrinsic sort of places to really do meaningful, great learning. I broke into education when I learned about a startup called Zinch, and its motto was students are more than a test score. You know, and that spoke just, you know, right to that experience that I had. And it was all about giving students holistic representation in their college admissions rather than just their test scores and their grades. So very passionate about that. I joined them, would help grow that business for 4 years. We would move to San Francisco as a part of that. We were acquired by Chegg, which is now a publicly traded education company. I then consulted for a time for a university, and their objective was to become the have the lowest price point, become the most affordable accredited university in America. Was with them for a small period of time. They were going through reaccreditation. They were beginning to leverage a lot of online resources to try and bring costs down. And that's really what led up to me starting Degreed. And Degreed was a sort of a thesis that I'd held for, you know, almost that whole time. I mean, nearly sort of 7, 8, 9 years, which was this belief that how I got there was sort of this. Cost feels like the biggest problem. Tuition's going up, student debt is going up, real wages are flat. The cost of higher education is a problem. How do we fix it? And the market first sort of came at that problem saying, let's democratize education. The MOOCs, e-learning, if we bring this learning online, it'll democratize it and it'll drive the cost to zero. Free courses equals free learning, free education. Well, it equals free learning. It doesn't equal free education. And I really believed that the value of education, and Michael Spence won a Nobel Prize for this, so this isn't even my original thinking, but the value of education isn't held in the learning. The value of education is held in the signaling and the credential. And I really believed that if we were going to meaningfully disrupt the cost equation, that you needed to address the credential, not the learning. So while everyone else was really sort of focused on the MOOCs, and you know, we had Khan Academy and Code Academy, these different models emerged. We had the boot camps, Dev Boot Camp, Hack Reactors, others sort of emerged right at that same time. You'd see Khan Academy, you know, came into the mainstream right at that same time. You had Udemy, you had you know, just all these people were in this effort to democratize learning, which was great, but I really oriented towards how do we disrupt the signal and the credential, and so focused on how can we get to a place where we can measure efficiently and you know, effectively someone's lifelong education and skills. So Degreed was born out of that thesis. And as I led up to this, you know, would ask people, tell me about your education. And they always answer with where they went to university or what degree they have. And, you know, that really is just this absurdity. We're so conditioned to hear it that we, you know, we think nothing of it. But I think to draw it out, you know, if I ask you, Diogo, tell me about your health. And you said, Dave, I ran a marathon 17 years ago, you know, that's an absurdity. Like, we know that, like, your health in this moment is in, you know, such a teeny infinitesimal, you know, way, in any way now related to what you did 17 years ago. You know, and it doesn't mean the marathons are bad. It just means like, that's an absurd way to answer for your health. And when we talk about, you know, our education, that's exactly what we do. We say, you know, hey, I graduated 17 years ago from here with this degree, and say it as if it's a rational thing. And it's just not. It's an absolute absurdity. And, you know, and that's a good equation for an opportunity to disrupt that something, you know, to launch a business. Is just the market is operating with under absurd sort of pretenses. And there's just such a gigantic opportunity to give individuals, to give universities, to give employers, you know, a new and better way to answer for someone's lifelong education and skills.
That's what Degreed does, right? What we're trying to do. Yeah, and we can get into some examples later on. But I actually had this question later on. But since you already mentioned the paradigms and the SAT and the difference between learning and education and the way we think we learn, you know, in organizations today, because I it's my hope that the people that are listening to this in organizations are thinking themselves about this. What are the most common myths or mistakes or paradigms that we as learning, especially in the learning function, but also in every single function or leadership position, that we are holding or that we are promoting that we shouldn't, and how can we start to switching from those myths and paradigms about learning and how people learn and how we will become learning organizations.
Hola Explorer, gracias por estar aquí. Te quito un minutito solamente para recordarte por qué existe Dare to Learn, cuál es nuestro propósito. Y es que nuestro propósito es ayudarte a ti y a tu organización, a tus equipos, a hacerle frente al futuro del trabajo. ¿Cómo lo hacemos? A través de nuestras experiencias de aprendizaje, nuestros cursos, nuestras conferencias, nuestros talleres, que se abocan a desarrollar las capabilities humanas más relevantes para que todos podamos hacer frente a los retos del presente y del futuro del trabajo. Te invitamos a que conozcas nuestra oferta en daretolearn.com.mx, o mejor aún, me puedes enviar un correo directamente a diego@daretolearn.com.mx y juntos podemos explorar cómo podemos ayudarte justamente con tus retos de talento, tus retos de aprendizaje y justamente el desarrollo de tu gente para hacerle frente al futuro del trabajo que ya es presente. Como una pequeña muestra de agradecimiento por ser parte de la comunidad de Dare to Learn, queremos regalarte un 70% de descuento en uno de nuestros cursos estrella, Time Ownership. Solo tienes que ingresar D2L70OFF, con doble F, todo con mayúsculas, en la página del curso de Time Ownership, y ahí podrás obtener este beneficio del 70% de descuento exclusivo para nuestra comunidad escuchas del podcast. Solamente quiero decirte que esto es una pequeña muestra de lo que podemos hacer por ti, pero tenemos mucho más que ofrecerte. Te queremos dar este pequeño regalo para que empieces a atreverte a ser dueño de tu tiempo y atreverte a aprender como ya lo estás haciendo. Gracias de nuevo por estar aquí y de vuelta con el invitado. Dare to Learn.
Yeah, I mean, I think a really common one is that sort of the better the school, the smarter the student. You know, I mean, that's not true. Sort of Google famously, you know, has published on that topic that, you know, originally they hired and sourced only from top Ivy League universities, and, you know, but came over time to realize that there was no sort of correlation with what universities people were coming out of and the success they had on the job. Another really common one, I think, is just generally we overestimate our abilities. You know, if you, there's also research that's been published on surveyed Google engineers, like how skilled are you relative to other Google engineers? And like everyone responds that they're in the top
80%.
Yeah, like exactly. And, you know, we tend to overestimate our capabilities, our abilities, our knowledge. And why it's important to say that is because it's, you know, at some level that becomes a hindrance to us being open as learners, to be open-minded, to realize that there's still, you know, an immense amount that we don't know, and to sort of drive through with our learning.
All right. And I love that. I think these may be answered with some of the examples that you know, and you also put on your book, The Expertise Economy, that I really love, with Kelly Palmer, another guest of this podcast. But because I love the part where you talk about the myths on how we learn, but also on how we as learning and development heads, we promote those myths. And can you tell us about some organizations that you have seen that are actually switching or flipping the coin to the other side of what we should do about learning? You mentioned about, for example, the how can we help employees to actually measure what they know and what they should learn. I know you are into the, I love the concept, if you can explain also about the skills quotient. A lot of us are talking about digital learning strategy or data analytics, but what are you seeing that the organizations are doing differently that are setting them apart as learning organizations?
Sure. Yeah. And you asked a couple of questions in there, and happy to try and get through and answer them and let me know if I miss any of it. But I think, you know, examples of great organizations leading great learning organizations, you know, sort of the right way. I mean, met recently with Lena, the chief HR officer at Unilever. And, you know, I mean, they've done a magnificent job in building a culture of empowerment in the development of their people. And I think, you know, that sounds obvious. Empowerment is better than not empowering people. And, you know, it's sort of this business buzzword. But I think to draw out in contrast what people do that is wrong or when they're doing it poorly, which is sort of this premise that sort of the old world was a world in which learning was driven from the top down and primarily by the needs of the organization. So in the corporate world, why are we going to bother training people? Like, there was really only one answer to that, which was we're paying them. They are our employees. And to the extent we develop them, we only do so because it serves our needs. It's to equip them to do the job, to meet the corporate objective. And so training really was driven explicitly from the needs of the organization and from the top down. So the problem with that is that as the pace of innovation accelerates, we are now have entered a world where technology can scale faster than humans learn. And that is creating a massive global skills gap, which in turn is creating a shortage of high-skilled labor. And yet the world continues to innovate and scale and move forward. And so that's put enormous pressure back onto organizations to have, to have highly skilled people. And there is now a shortage and no one really has sort of fully enough of the skills. And it's become the great governor. You know, businesses can really only now move as fast and compete to the extent that they have to what extent they have sort of the portion of high-skilled labor. And what that means is that there's an immense premium on highly skilled people and developing skills. But the old way of saying, all right, we are going to skill our people based on our needs that the company has and to do so in a coordinated command and control fashion just is such a antiquated and ill-equipped model to operate in this world of faster pace and higher, bigger skills gap and shortage of highly skilled people. The only chance that organizations have of operating successfully in this environment is to fight fire with fire. Technology now scales faster than humans can learn. The only chance we have is empowering individuals to learn in a personalized way enabled by technology. And so to get to that, you have to realize that companies can't control, have this command and control model. The only way companies are going to keep pace is if they empower each person inside the organization to learn in a very personalized way against the, immediately the needs that that person has in their job, you know, on any given week, against the objectives and hopes that that person has in their career. And so it's a shift of command and control to a model where you have to empower your people. And it is a massive shift in terms of the systems required, in terms of the culture required, in terms of the permissioning required. To go back to where I started, Unilever has done just an amazing job at really empowering their people, taking that sort of leap of faith of saying, you know, we're no longer going to control, we're going to empower. And begin to think of people, how do we meet the needs of each worker rather than how do we make sure that each worker is meeting our needs? You know, and so that's just a massive shift, and they've embraced it and done a really great job, and they're seeing, incredible fruits from that effort.
Do you have a little detail, some details about how they are doing this? I mean, are they just putting the big trends or objectives and then letting people, allowing them time or money, or you know how they are doing this?
Yeah, and it's in Lena's LinkedIn feed, but you know she's published some of the results of just the actual results that the organization has seen as a function of all this. You know, I believe people are being promoted at a much faster rate than they were before. which is a great sign of internal mobility and the fact that people are learning and developing and advancing faster. You know, really the way I think, look, here's how you can think about this, which is a different analogy. I don't want to mince all my analogies. I'll move to a new one, but it really does parallel this sort of command and control model versus empowering, supporting people model. But education, our systems of education used to be like building a railroad. It was a heavy infrastructure project that was meant to move people from one point and advance them forward and move them to, you know, a point further down the line. But, you know, in a world where education and information is scarce, it took a lot of work. It was, you had to bring professors all physically to one place, or you had to bring the instructors physically to one place. You had to bring students physically to one place. You had to have physical buildings to do so. You had to have physical infrastructure. You had to have texts and resources that were published because, you know, before the internet, you had to literally get it in a book or it didn't exist anywhere. And so education was this heavy infrastructure project where, again, you laid the tracks and, you know, and you had to choose, okay, you know, we can lay one line of track, we can maybe lay two lines of track, but we can't lay infinite lines of track. And so if you're only going to have one or two, you know, programs that you can build, then you have to think, well, we're going to build the program that's going to help the most people, you know, that starts where generally there's the most need. And it's going to move people down the track, and there might be one or two stops, but it's going to take people to generally the point where we can take the most people collectively and have it be of some value. You know, if you think about that, and that's how railroads work. And now think of our infrastructure today and think of Uber and Lyft and Google Maps and Apple Maps, where we can today pull out our phone, have a GPS pinpoint exactly where we are in the world. We can give any destination we want in the world, and Google Maps will tell us, you know, the best, shortest, most efficient route to get between those two points. Well, that's where organizations need to go, because you can no longer do this work. I mean, trains, you know, they just aren't the most efficient way of personalizing transportation, of getting people from truly where they're beginning their journey to truly where they're going to end their journey. You know, and the same is true with our education. It's no longer sufficient to just say, hey, we're going to create this program. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're truly starting from. You know, you are going to come generically go through this program, and we are going to generically spit you out the other end. Now we've got to say, where exactly are you in the world? Where exactly are you trying to go? And how do we get you there? You know, and that's the world we have to move to. So what do organizations have to do to enable that future? You have to know what skills people have in real time, and most organizations don't. You have to be able to show for any destination what skills are required to be successful. And most organizations aren't good at that. And then to close that gap, you have to be able to show the most efficient route or learning pathway between those two points, you know, more and more organizations are becoming equipped at that part of it. You know, so what does Unilever do well? They index all of their job opportunities, relate it back to the skills required, make that transparent inside the organization, and then align all of their learning resources to those skills. And then in making that transparent to the organization, now all of a sudden, as an employee, I can go from, you know, career pathing used to look like a railroad map. If I pulled up a corporate career path that says you are here, you know, and it usually goes and forks off in one or two directions. And so I believe in that old world, I believe my opportunities are only one or two paths, you know, go left or go right, you know, become a staff accountant too, or become a, you know, controller, you know, junior controller. But now all of a sudden in a world where I can see all of the jobs and how my skills map to and overlap with all of the jobs inside the organization, I now have sort of infinite directions I can go. I can choose something that's truly fulfilling. I can see what skills I'm missing and autonomously on my own without ever going to HR or to my manager or to a corporate learning and development person. I on my own can see what skills I need to develop and start working on it, you know, with the best, most efficient resources. You know, and that's a powerful world. It's a huge shift. I'd say it's one that's still, I wouldn't say I've seen any organization who just has all three parts of that nailed, measuring people's skills, indexing all of the jobs and the skills required to be successful, and then the learning resources to close those gaps. But we are starting to see some organizations be much better at it than others.
That's cool. That's really cool. I mean, I love about the indexing all the jobs. That'd be great. I mean, just to actually being able to build paths for people. And it would be great to get to meet, what's the name of her? Unilever, her name?
Yeah, it's Lena.
Lena. It'd be great.
Last name.
Because I do know that the CEO of Unilever has declared that people, I mean, he's also a very vocal leader on the learning side. So, and Unilever is such a leader in their industry. So it's great to know these stories. And I'm pretty sure there are a lot of more of those.
Yeah, Lena Nair.
Great. I will look for her in LinkedIn. So just to be clear, I was thinking on our interview, and I don't know if we have explained exactly what is Degreed doing right now, but I think it will be great because one question that I have, and it's a compounded question, is what is the strongest argument someone who disagrees with Degreed mission has given you? Or
let me
you up?
What does Degreed do, and people who disagree with us, why do they? No, so Degreed was born out of this belief, again, that we needed to answer for our lifetime of education and skills. We saw the market emerging with all this new e-learning and different platforms and models and boot camps and upskilling, all these different models of learning. They were all really islands unto themselves. So you have a boot camp here, you have a university here, you have, you know, lynda.com over here, you have Pluralsight, you have, you know, but as learners, we don't just ever learn one place anymore. We journey across platforms and modalities and destinations. You know, we'll read an article on Wall Street Journal or on The Economist, and then we'll watch a video on YouTube. Then we'll listen to a podcast. Then we will read a book. Then we will, you know, might take an online course. And then we will be on our jobs taking a corporate training. Then we'll go to a conference and we'll go to an event. We travel between modalities, destinations, and providers of education. And Degreed really looked at that and said, there's ever more new and better destinations of learning, but no one is serving the learner as they have to journey across this vast landscape of learning. And so Degreed is, you technically don't even learn anything on Degreed. We really are just the place to support you in your journey as you travel between those destinations. So Degreed is a portable lifelong learning transcript that helps you track all of your learning, articles, videos, books, conferences, events, universities, certificates, programs, really any way you can learn or demonstrate learning, and then help you, you know, set goals, track it, curate it, share it, make it social, you know, and then inside the corporate setting, see how, you know, share with your team, see your team's objectives, see what, again, those jobs and what skills are required inside of the organization. How does the corporate learning resources align with all of those needs? So we play this sort of support lifelong support role for every individual. Anyone can use Degreed for free. You can go sign up. The business model is that when we do it with corporations, they pay us to enable all of this inside of their organization and beyond. You know, why? I think, you know, that really is been sort of five of the last, you know, 7 to 8 years for Degreed. In the last couple of years, we really have moved more to what I articulated, which is the future is being able to assess people's skills in real time, being able to be transparent with what skills are required for any objective or destination, and then giving people a pathway to close that gap. And so now the frontier for us is helping to measure people's skills in real time and that work of indexing all of the opportunities and the skills required. You know, when people disagree with us, why? I mean, early on, I found myself with, a lot of people found what we were doing exciting. A lot of people found it curious, but a lot of people also, didn't believe. I mean, it was a really hard first year, 2 years, 3 years. I mean, degreed was really hard early on. And I think a lot of that came from, this insistence. I mean, when degreed launched, college degrees were still sacrosanct. You know, to question the value of a college degree was, maybe besides the Pope, there's just, the infallibility of the college degree was nearly unquestioned. Yeah. The earnings premiums on degrees. I mean, it's the only credential in the world that's universal, that every country uses, that every employer, uses, that, it was sacrosanct. And we say our mission is to jailbreak the degree. And so, early on, we just found ourselves, with a lot of people who I think were blinded or couldn't see past, that there was any room beyond the college degree or any need for anything beyond it, or that the world would ever move to a place where it was operating on anything other than the college degree. And just like the example I cited earlier, tell me about your health and you say you ran a marathon 17 years ago. Our argument isn't even really premised on whether college degrees are good or bad. A marathon, that answer isn't absurd because marathons are absurd. That answer is absurd because answering with what you did 17 years ago is absurd. The college degree, its place that it has in our world, in our society, in our economy, its absurdity is really not even premised on whether or not it is good or bad. The absurdity of it is our reliance and dependency on it as the only mechanism to answer the question. So when we say jailbreak the degree, we're not anti-college, we're not even anti-degrees. We really are just trying to move the world forward to a place where we can answer with our education and skills in real time today. Not, point back 15, 17, 20, 30 years with what we did then.
That's great. That's great. And a couple of questions. Are you seeing already examples of companies, for example, taking decisions based on new credentials for hiring or for promoting in between the degreed customers? Or I love the expertise economy, as I mentioned to you before, but for this skills quotient, have you seen companies already using this for taking decisions, like the data that this is allowing them to do? Because in the book, you are at least at that moment, you are very explicit that let me put you some hypothetical examples. But I didn't understand if it was hypothetical because you wouldn't mention the names of the companies or because it wasn't already being used. So I would love to hear of examples of companies that are doing this, like in a day-to-day basis.
So I think I hear two questions. What's the skills quotient and how do people use it? And then, are organizations beginning to hire based on alternative credentials? To the latter question very quickly, yes. I keep a Google Doc of all of the big blue chip companies who have said they're no longer requiring college degrees in their job descriptions or job requirements. And degreed has played a small part in that, but I don't even believe we can take the credit for that. I think, so much of that is simply just a function of supply and demand, where the demand for skills is immense and the supply of talent is short. Anytime that's true, you see companies begin to abandon degree requirements and open themselves up to other signals. And I think we will continue to see more and more of that. To your prior question, the skills quotient, what is it and how do companies use it? The skills quotient is a open framework that anyone can use to have a common way of answering for the skills that the company has, the skills that the company needs, and essentially the gap between the two. Why we believe this is important, you know, in the book, we use the example of Net Promoter Score. So many are familiar with that now. Not everyone will be, but, you know, every company now has someone whose job it is to measure Net Promoter Score of their product or service. And truly every CEO worth their salt knows what the Net Promoter Score of their products are. And Net Promoter Score is a way of benchmarking customer satisfaction. And if you look at that example, you know, it came out as if I recall, 2003. I might be off on that. Not great with dates, but circa 2003. And before that, you know, the world, the science of customers surveying had existed for a really long time, but every company was just doing it their own way. You know, so you'd survey, you'd come up with your own survey, you'd ask them questions, you know, some by mail, some in store, some online as that developed. But everyone was asking different questions. And so there's no real way of calibrating or benchmarking. You know, okay, so we say we're 7 stars out of 10, but, you know, is that because of how we asked the question, or, you know, is that even better or worse than our competitors? I don't know. And even, you know, across time, it was messy. So it was just like this big jumble, this big black box. And then along came a framework that was a very straightforward way of measuring customer satisfaction, Net Promoter Score. Single question, would you recommend this to a friend on a 0 to 10 scale? Promoters are 9 and 10s, passives are 7 and 8s, and detractors are the 0 through 6. There's a scoring, which is essentially your promoters minus your detractors, gives you a Net Promoter Score. It's on a scale of a -100 to 100. And all of a sudden, with that very simple framework, that was really the first way of giving everyone a common language to do customer satisfaction, to then benchmark it over time internally to see it progress. So if you look at, you know, where are we right now in the world of skills? Well, it's immensely important, becoming more important every day. People are making efforts to measure it, to do so. There's ever more, ever new alternative credentials, you know, and we're kind of the same place the world was with customer satisfaction sort of 15, 20 years ago, which is just messy. You know, okay, so, you know, our IT department has 76, you know, Cisco certifications. Our engineers are 3 stars out of 5. Our, you know, frontline managers all just got nano degrees. You know, we surveyed people over here. They're scoring 72. You know, it's just this jumble that is impossible to calibrate, to normalize, and to then benchmark. Skills quotient is a framework of essentially measuring the skills you have divided by the skills you need, you know, times by a multiplier to give you a 0 to 100 measure of your skills. And why this is powerful is all of a sudden you can come to the organization and say, all right, you know, we are a 62 here, we're a 72 here. We used to be, you know, 50 and 55. We've made material progress over here in finance. We're a 50. We used to be a 62. We've dropped. Why is that? You know, is that because we lost highly skilled people? Is that because we had an incoming class of young, unskilled workers? Is that because the skills we need moved forward and our workforce has stayed the same? And it begins to, you can then answer those second order questions. You can begin to pull back the layers. You can begin to benchmark this over time. You can begin to benchmark this across departments and across teams. You can benchmark this between companies. It gives the world a very simple framework to have a common language to engage in this conversation. And we believe that is going to be immensely important over the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years as the world has to grapple with this growing skills gap.
I love it. And I would love to discuss later on with you, if possible, in a future conversation, how you guys are helping our organizations to measure exactly that in a big scale. And I'm saying a later conversation because we are running out of time. And I actually have one question that I didn't have in my outline, but I'm just going to do it. Even sure. if it takes us a little, if we need to cut on something else. But when you were talking about this, the common language and having something we all talk about, I just recently have a conversation with a group of learning and development heads here in Mexico. And we talk about, have you heard about the 70-20-10 model? Mm-hmm. It was a very candid and heated conversation about, does that really work? I mean, who came up with that? And one guy that I really respect there, he said, well, at least it gave us a common language for all. And I said, well, yeah, but is that enough? I'm thinking on the 70-20-10 because all of us, we have it in our learning models. It's like the common language, but then it starts to simplify more complicated conversations from my point of view. Like everything, that's on the 20, that's on the 10, that's on the 70. And we are kind of oversimplifying things. But then I think of the grid, I think a lot of us think of the grid, for example, or the learning online as on the 10 part. But you mentioned already that we should be able to measure everything. And I'm saying this, of course, I want to hear your take on the 70-20-10, and this is what I'm saying, but this connects with other questions that I do have, like how we should help others to move from knowledge to skills, to actually develop skills, because I think that's a big challenge, a big gap that we haven't been able to close in organizations. Sure. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot there. I mean, really quickly, I think, you know, how do I feel about 70-20-10? I feel, you know, it's 20 years old and antiquated and outdated. Do I feel like it was important? Yes. You know, did it give people a common framework to operate on? Yes. You know, frameworks, you know, they aren't inherently none of them are perfect. Like it's arbitrary is maybe the best way of framing it. It truly is arbitrary, which is, you know, net promoter score. Why is it 9 and 10s that are promoters? Why isn't it over 8, 9s and 10s? Why is it, you know, why is there these passives of 7 and 8s? Why, you know, further you think about, you know, what it masks, you know, what it tells you. Someone who answered, would you recommend, you know, this service or product to a friend? If you answer with a 6, you are being scored the exact same way as if you answer with a 1. You know, a 1 is, I hate you. Like you made my life worse off. And a 6 is like a meh. No, not really, but meh. And yet net promoter score accounts for that difference. Not at all. 0. Yeah. There's no reflection in the net promoter score of your 1s versus your 6s. It all gets scored the same. You know, so why? Well, you know, you're trading off sort of complexity with heuristics. And, you know, and you just have to ask, you know, what job is this tool doing for me? And does it do it well? And, you know, is it important? And I think, you know, right now, the world has no language for skills. And, you know, and it's that void is being filled by essentially, if you think of skills as currency, it's beginning to be filled by people printing their own, you know, nickels and dimes. I mean, everyone's printing their own currency, and that creates its own problems, which is you show up to you know, and you hand me your wooden nickels, and I don't know what those mean. And you know, am I willing to accept those? No, not likely. You know, there needs to be some language, some framework that can establish, you know, common understanding, can create trust. And we believe that this is a very meaningful step for where the world is at right now. You know, is the whole world using the skills quotient, you know, 5-10 years from now? I hope so. Is the world using the skills quotient sort of 20 years from now? I probably hope not. You know, I hope world's evolved and gotten more sophisticated, and the problems have become, you know, smaller or more nuanced, and we need more sophisticated tools to continue to serve us well. You know, so I think it isn't meant, you know, as we go around the world having conversations about this, you know, people are quick to raise their hand and say, you know, but what about? And it's, and there's really valid points to be made, you know, just like net promoter score. It isn't perfect. We aren't saying it's perfect. There's parts of it that it's just sort of, it's a heuristic, but it does the job that the world needs. And, you know, if you go to Peter Drucker, you know, you can't improve what you can't measure. And right now, you know, there's not a CEO in the world who can answer what skills does your organization have, what skills does your organization need, and do so in a codified, universal way.
Love it.
And we have to get there. So, you know, I hope this meets the moment. I hope it serves us and organizations well. A lot really truly is on the line, both the health of organizations, but more importantly, you know, a world in which our own well-being and our organizations and in the workplace and in our lives is increasingly dependent on our ability to be good lifelong learners, to continue to skill and upskill, to stay relevant in this, you know, world of increasing skills inequity. The skills gap is a wedge. People who get on top of it are rewarded ever more richly. People who, you know, can't clear the chasm and remain at the bottom, you know, the outlook is dire. It is deeply important that we equip and empower everyone as best as we can to develop themselves to the fullest that they might, you know, because that's what's is going to determine our success and our well-being increasingly in the future.
And I know this is a hard one, but what will be your one recommendation for individuals to actually reach that gap or to start focusing on being future ready?
Yeah, you know, I think, I mean, there's a couple of, I think, just easy ways to think about it. But I mean, one is, do you have a learning goal? I go around the world talking to learning audiences, educators, and ask people by the raise of hands, how many of you have a written goal regarding your own personal learning today? And so few hands go up. You know, lifelong learning, we don't have teachers, we don't have schools, we don't have the same scaffolding. To be a good lifelong learner means you've got to be the agent of your own learning. I think a really important and easy place to start is just set a goal. You know, as a rule of thumb, I think it should be about 10% of your time, of your working professional time. If you're, you know, working 40 hours a week, you need to be learning 4 hours a week, you know.
I love it. That's a very, a rule of thumb, you said, right?
Yep.
I like it. Yep. So you have another 5 minutes to spare?
I've got three.
All right. So just one question then. So can you tell us what's something about that you recently learned that you think potentially is going to change your life?
Yeah, that's quite the criteria. I have a lot of examples of that in my life. I mean, I've learned things that have set my life off on substantially different courses. I mean, I spent the last 2 years, I launched a nonprofit called Vice.Run. Which came from learning about seeking solutions for our ever-widening partisan divide and ever sort of worsening political conversations. It led me to the history of the vice presidency, the American vice presidency. You know, and I spent the last 2 years working on a nonprofit to reclaim Americans' 12th Amendment rights to democratically and directly elect a vice president. You know, and that all came from you know, books that I read and learnings. You know, I think
that's great.
You know, there's a book I read. You know, there's been a lot of books that I look back on and truly think they were sort of linchpins in my course. You know, that set me off in certain directions.
From Seth Godin, the one from Seth Godin.
Yeah, I mean probably the most. The one that set my life off on this course was Emotional Intelligence, was the name of the book.
Oh, because I'm sorry, I thought there's a book called Lynchpin by Seth Godin. So I thought that
there is. I just use that term, not reference the book.
Emotional Intelligence.
Enjoyed that book, but
Emotional Intelligence is the name of the book you said.
Emotional Intelligence. Yeah.
All right. Well. That's good, and I think it's gonna be I am sure you're gonna have very successful in that initiative, and I will put some links on that for the guys that want to know what are you into now and where they can find you, and yeah. Well, that will be it, and I don't know if you have any final remarks we can just.
I enjoyed being on with you today, and you know, the future belongs to the learners.
Great. All right, David. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time. Have a great one.
Thank you.
Muchas gracias, Explorer, por acompañarnos en un episodio más del Dare to Learn podcast. Estoy seguro que, al igual que yo, debes haber encontrado muchísima sabiduría, insights y cosas bien interesantes que nos compartió nuestro invitado. Te quiero pedir un favor. Para que seamos más la comunidad de Learning Explorers, es importante que compartas lo que aprendiste. Para que seamos más los que estamos en ese camino del aprendizaje continuo, es importante que lo compartas con alguien que le pueda servir y que se trepe esta comunidad de Learning Explorers para que cada vez seamos más los que entendemos el poder transformador del aprendizaje, los que no dejamos de aprender todo el tiempo. Te pido que nos des un like, un review, o ya sea un comentario en tus redes, en las nuestras, donde sea que escuches tus podcasts. Lo importante es que cada vez seamos más los que estamos hablando de este tema, los que despertamos al poder transformador del aprendizaje. En Instagram nos vas a encontrar como DareToLearnMX, por si quieres también seguirnos por ahí. En Facebook y en el resto de las redes sociales, en LinkedIn estamos como DareToLearn, dos con el to learn es un dos, DareDosLearn. Y bueno, a mí particularmente, si me quieres escribir, me puedes escribir a diego@daretolearn.com.mx. Ahí me puedes mandar un correo, vamos a tener una conversación más personal. O visítanos en la página, ya la sabes, daretolearn.com.mx. Y bueno, con eso me despido, invitándote a que nos hagas saber de ti, a que nos hagas saber qué fue lo que aprendiste. Y antes de irme ya, ahora sí definitivamente, no puedo dejar de agradecer, como siempre, de todo corazón, a mi amigo de toda la vida y brother, Rodolfo Rudy Gallardo, que es el máster de la postproducción de estos audios y que tiene magia en esas manos. Ya sé que estos episodios lleguen a ti con la calidad con la que llegan. Si te interesa contactar a Rudy para algo de producción de audio, ve a produccionesorga@gmail.com, le puedes mandar un mail, o en Instagram como produccionesorga. Y bueno, sin mucho más, nos vemos en la próxima edición del podcast de Dare to Learn. Atrévete a aprender y gracias por estar aquí. Chao.